It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show I talk to Alex Wu, former Pixar animator and director of the new Netflix film In Your Dreams, about being real with children in the stories we tell them. We review The Running Man and Russell Crowe in Nuremberg. Plus, I talk to Stephen McKenna, the writer, director and financier of his debut feature, Dreamtown. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com and the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're surviving the wind and the rain. Now, we always start talking about TV, or we usually do, but I should mention that the piece of TV I was most glued to all week was Thursday night at 7:45. Well, I didn't start till about 8 o'clock because I was working late, and it was Ireland v Portugal. And you know, to use a film analogy, as Darth Vader says in Star Wars, "I felt a presence I haven't felt in a long time," when he senses Obi-Wan Kenobi. And as a 50-year-old man who has been watching Irish soccer since kind of 1988 and haven't felt the frisson, the buzz of possible qualification in a long time, I felt that feeling on Thursday night, and it was wonderful. Now, I don't want to jinx anything, right? You're damning these things, but that feeling, It was on the edges. It was coming back in. So good luck to them. Anyway, to the more pedestrian type of TV we usually talk about. This week, I was watching this.
My stuff took off because they'd never seen a young black person take charge.
Oh, the new sheriff is now.
He had the number one movie, comedy special, and pop song.
It was unprecedented.
He's like a miracle.
From stand-up comic to big screen sex symbol.
That's what they said. I didn't say it.
He went from being the raw guy to the family guy.
I already ate pizza.
You ate my slice?
I want to show them that I'm not like anybody in this town. I'm everybody in the scene and everything in between.
He amplified black talent.
He changed the world.
Not just American culture, he changed the world.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yes, the unmistakable sound of Eddie Murphy there, and Manny of his well-known fans and supporters. So this is a new documentary on Netflix. It's 1 hour and 50 minutes. It launched on Wednesday, called Being Eddie, all about Eddie Murphy. Here's the thing. So Eddie Murphy, who was on this show last year talking about the latest Beverly Hills Cop, which I was delighted about. And I told him, I remember watching Beverly Hills Cop as a 10 or 11 year old on VHS. And I love Eddie Murphy. And so this documentary has his career, which is fascinating. He kind of ushered in a whole new era of comedy, of success for black comedians and black actors. He's an actor like no one else in the stuff that he can do. If you look at something like Nutty Professor and all the roles he played, same thing with Coming to America. He sings. He was a stand-up. He did these stand-up shows, you know, where he was doing Madison Square Garden and stuff. He, you know, was a successful black man in a time when there were so few of them. So this contains all of that, and it's great to see all that. However, on the other side of things, this may be the puffiest piece of puff pieces I've seen in a very long time. So Eddie Murphy, as well as the huge success, has had a complicated life. He has 10 children with lots of different partners. Famously had a contentious relationship with Mel B. He was arrested or questioned by the police for picking up a transsexual prostitute. He said he was giving her a lift. Those aforementioned comedy specials like Raw and Delirious were highly successful, but they contain very homophobic comments. Now, I'm not saying he should have been cancelled or anything like that, and he has apologised from over the years, but there is no reference to any of those things in this documentary. It is just him saying, God, I've done well, and people saying, God, hasn't he done well? And he has, but there is no nuance to this whatsoever. If you take the Charlie Sheen documentary from a couple of weeks ago, you know, that man was broken and is very honest about the brokenness. I raved about the Billy Joel documentary back in the summer, which I would have, of course, because I'm a massive fan, as you know. But again, you know, long details of drinking and being a bad husband. And these characters like Charlie Sheen or Billy Joel or Robbie Williams, you know, for their honesty about their misdeeds, they're just more appealing, you know, because it's human to do misdeeds. Let's be honest about it. Eddie Murphy does not pay attention to any misdeeds or any shade in his career whatsoever. So I liked it because we got to see some great clips and him talking about some of those roles, but it is so self-congratulatory. It's off the charts. So what am I saying? If you're a fan of Eddie Murphy, watch it. But you will be left kind of reeling by the lack of self-examination he engages in, I have to say. That's Being Eddie on Netflix. Now, I want to get to the week's new cinema releases, but I do want to quickly mention All Her Fault on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. You may have read about this. Sarah Snook, who was Shiv in Succession, plays a mother whose son goes missing. She goes to pick him up from a play date, and the play date appears to have never happened, and her son is missing. And what we have is 7 episodes of her trying to find out what happened. Now, quite tellingly, my wife, who watches most of this stuff with me, said, I'm not watching this, because she just couldn't do missing child. And I get that. And I reluctantly sat down going, this is going to be hard to watch. But this is a great watch because, of course, it's a horror show because it's about a child missing, which is every parent's and, you know, every person's nightmare. But what happens very quickly in this show is not that you forget about that, but it kind of devolves into a brilliant whodunit. And there are all sorts of questions being asked. I really can't get into any more because it's spoiler ridden and there are a lot of threads. But all I will say is there's a payoff and the threads all work. It's a great watch. It really is. All Her Fault on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. Gripping, gripping drama. Let me know what you might have been watching. Screentime at newstalk.com is the email address. We turn to the new cinema releases of the week. The big one is The Running Man. Yes, the remake of the 1987 movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. We're also going to look at Nuremberg, where Russell Crowe plays Goring. I'm delighted to be joined in studio in corporeal form by entertainment journalist and host of Screenland podcast, Brian Lloyd. Brian, hello.
How you doing?
So listen, I have a vague memory. Well, not a vague memory because I watched it on VHS. Arnie running in The Running Man back in 1987 or 1988. Yep. You're a little younger than me. Was that movie any good?
It was okay. I mean, It was directed by Paul Michael Glaser, who was at the time kind of more known, I think, for kind of TV work. I mean, obviously, yes, Starsky and Hutch, but he had been done a few episodes and whatever. And I think the point that they were trying to kind of work into it was that this was a TV show in a movie, if you get my meaning. Like, they wanted that TV kind of element in it. But no, I mean, like, I always kind of think, like, Arnie's movies in the 80s are on a sliding scale between cheesy and crap. And this was on the wrong side of that scale, whereas something like Commando was on the right side of it.
And, of course, Terminator.
Well, Terminator was, I mean, Terminator is off on its own.
Okay, good. Okay.
Like, I do think Terminator, you can't really...
Terminator doesn't belong in that scale.
No, not at all. And same, I would put Conan the Barbarian as well. I mean, I do think that's on another kind of scale of its own. Like, because, I mean, like, what John Milius did in that, have you ever go back and watch? Have you ever watched it recently?
I just, whenever I see clips and it's the voice and I just, no.
No, do you know what, right? You need to watch the first, like, I'd say 15 minutes of Conan the Barbarian.
Really?
Yes, I am. Believe me when I'm, no. I'm telling you right now. It is like opera. It's really like opera. The score that Basil Poledouris does in that, the fact that it's done with like very sparse dialogue. There's only just like the kind of the opening monologue, which is done by a very good actor, where he talks about the riddle of steel and the idea. No, really.
Okay.
Trust me.
And I know you're a big fan of opera. Listen, we're going down a tiny rabbit hole here.
Sorry.
So No, it's fascinating. But that was 1987, yes. 1988. This is based on a Stephen King novel. Mm. They have reinvented it or redone it with Glenn Powell as the now running man. So give us the premise.
So the premise is that it's set in the near future. A global television network runs pretty much all of America. The top rated show on this TV network is The Running Man, which for 30 days... you will be pursued by a group of hunters. If you survive the 30 days, you will win $1 billion. And as a little note to our man Arnold Schwarzenegger, he is on the face of the 100 new dollar bills.
Okay.
So Glenn Powell is recruited into this show after his daughter is ill and his wife is working in a seedy bar. He decides that he has nothing else going on in his life. So he decides that he's going to apply for this. He does it. He finds that his skills... working as a kind of an everyday man labor, translate into this world where he has to use his kind of his skill and his cunning and his resourcefulness to survive. Mm. Lee Pace plays this guy called Chief McClune, who wears this like face mask and leads this group of like, you know, military trained hunters that are coming after him.
And sorry to cut across you, this takes place in essence in the real world, like the whole world's a stage, is it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like Black
Mirror.
It's
not in a TV studio.
No. Yeah, it's out in the real world. So like, I mean, he goes from city to city. Like it starts off and he's in Co-op City, which we kind of assume is sort of like Los Angeles, we're not too sure. Mm. Then he ends up in New York, then he ends up in Boston, then he ends up sort of in rural America with Michael Cera and so on and so forth. Yeah. He actually goes to Derry, Maine, which is a nice reference to Stephen King.
Yeah.
Most of his books are set in Derry and Maine and so on and so forth. So it's kind of, it's him moving from place to place. The problem, I mean, one of the key problems with this film is the fact that the pacing is all over the shot.
Okay.
When it's kind of really cooking is when the action set pieces are there. Obviously, Edgar Wright, I mean, we look at Hot Fuzz, we look at, you know, Baby Driver. We know that he knows how to stage an action set piece. The problem is that, you know, like I would say, 40% of this film is Glenn Powell in a hotel room hiding out.
Okay.
And, you know, doing pieces to camera because that's part of the thing. Yeah. They have to keep recording these like selfie videos to send them off to the TV production.
Mm.
And then the other big problem with this is that Glenn Powell is just horribly, horribly miscast.
Because he's too nice?
Yes. That's really it. I mean, that's it. I mean, this character of Ben Richards is supposed to be downtrodden and, you know, full of rage at the system and just angry generally, you know, that kind of way. And Glenn Powell, I mean, he, you know, I'm not saying he's a limited actor, but, you know, no. I mean, like, he's very good at being charming. He's very good at that sort of easy, charismatic thing that a lot of American actors do very, very well. Matthew McConaughey, 30 years ago, you know, that sort of way. Put him in a rom-com, he's great. Put him in an easygoing Richard Linklater comedy like Everybody Hitman. Wants Him, or Hitman, he's great.
Mm.
Put him in something like this where there's a lot of edge to it and there's a lot of grit. He's kind of at sea, I think.
Okay. So the action set pieces didn't do it for you either, then?
No, they were good. I mean, this is it. They were good. I mean, again, Edgar Wright is very talented at turning action into slapstick comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, you go look at something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World or Hot Fuzz, you know, he can take the mechanics of an action set piece and turn it into fun. And this is not anything particularly new. I mean, Jackie Chan did this for years, you know, that sort of way. Like, he's able to kind of get the sort of the Charlie... I mean, look, yeah, you can take this all the way back to Harold Lloyd. The connection between comedy and action. So there is that element in this. But it's just that, again, the pacing is all over the place. And then there are other parts of it where, you know, you have like Katie O'Brien in this, who's a great, great actress. And she's used very, very poorly. Like, she only has like a couple of scenes in this. And then it goes to Colman Domingo and Josh Brolin.
And Colman Domingo is the host of this.
Yeah, he's the host of this. Yeah, yeah.
And he's in full Domingo mode.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And again, you know, I was watching this and it's like, okay, so he's just doing his version of Stanley Tucci in The Hunger Games. You know, that kind of big bravura, Caesar Flickerman-esque character. And it's great, but it's not enough, you know, that sort of way. It's all sizzle and no steak.
And you intimated to me before we came on air, there may have been a rewrite and a reshoot.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
How long? The last third?
I would say the last third of the film. It's very evident. Like, you can tell that the film is kind of building up towards something. It's really kind of, you know, it's angling towards something, and then it takes a hard left turn.
Okay.
Where, again, you know, you really can see it, the fact that this was thrown together very, very quickly, because it's a lot more disjointed, it's a lot more clipped. And, I mean, I don't know what the original ending was planned. I mean, the book is pretty grim.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe they were planning to do the original book. Again, like I said, the original ending of, I don't want to give it away, but it's very, very grim.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what they had written. And I would assume that this was tested out the bejesus. And when it was put in front of audiences, they were like, oh no, I hate it. We need something a bit more kind of colourful and a bit more.
So an unsatisfying ending?
Yes, very.
So listen, this is getting wildly different.
It is,
reviews.
Isn't it?
I've read 4 to 5 star reviews. I've heard 1 star reviews.
Yeah.
Where do you stand?
Oh, I'll hedge my bets. I said this to you off air. When I was watching it, I was enjoying it.
Okay.
And then I walked away and I started thinking at it. And then I started picking and pulling at it.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh God, it actually isn't that very, it isn't that good. Mm. It's enjoyable for what it is. When it's good, it's very good. When it's bad, it's terrible. So I'm going to hedge my bets. I'll say 2.5 out of 5.
Yeah. When you second judge your initial reaction to a movie, it's probably not a good
one. Yeah, this is it.
2.5, 5. So you're steering a course. Brian Lloyd gives The Running Man, the new version, the 2005 one, starring Glenn Powell, 2.5 stars. Let's take a quick clip.
People on these games never come back.
We have no choice. We need money for a doctor now.
Welcome to The Running Man. Contestants will be hunted for 30 days. Anyone can kill you.
Hunt him down!
Survive, and you will walk away with $1 billion.
I always thought this was fake. Feeling pretty real now.
A clip there from The Running Man, which Brian Lloyd gives 2.5 stars to. Something very different, one can only assume, although he was on the run. We're going to Nuremberg. The movie's called Nuremberg, and it's primarily Russell Crowe playing Goring. And they're deciding is it him at Nuremberg, or is it him being vetted to see if he can stand trial?
That's the first 30 minutes of the film.
Okay.
So Rami Malek plays Douglas Kelly, who is this US Army psychiatrist that was sent in to assess the mental health of the Nazi high command, starting with Hermann Göring.
Yeah.
And then as he goes through it, then the idea is to basically, he's on suicide watch. So in other words, he has to make sure that none of these Nazi commanders try to kill themselves before the trial, but also as well to, as you know, make sure that they are mentally fit and not insane, because one of them, a guy called Robert Ley, turned out actually was insane, or at least he was judged to be medically mentally unfit to stand trial. Yeah. But really what it, this is a problem that I had with this film, is that first of all, right away, Judgment at Nuremberg just looms over this like shadow. And the entire time you're watching it, you're thinking, okay, well, I've seen this before, and it was done far, far better. You had Burt Lancaster, and you know, it was just,
we should mention that's a movie from a long time
ago. From a long time ago, but a very, very relevant.
Yes.
Very, very well done. Still absolutely holds up. You know, really is one of the best, if not the best, legal thrillers ever made. So you have that, and that's kind of playing in the back of your mind. And then there's also the fact that Nuremberg is trying to be 10 different things at once. It's trying to be a legal drama where you have, you know, Michael Shannon's character, who plays Justice Robert Jackson, trying to kind of figure out, okay, what are we going to nail them on? Are we going to nail them on, you know, aggression of war? Are we going to nail them on crimes against humanity? And then there's the whole thing about, you know, this is international law. This hasn't really been set down in stone before. So we're going to have to set up the International Military Tribunal, where we're going to have to bring in the Soviet Union and the French and the Germans. And then it just literally handbrake turn into a sort of Jonathan Demme Silence of the Lambs thing, where it's Rami Malek and Russell Crowe in a tiny cell, you know, jousting with one another, and Goring is, you know, gregarious and charismatic, and he's almost sort of winning over Rami Malek.
And does that work? Because that's played big in the trailer.
It is. I will say that you know, Russell Crowe is the strong point in this. He is fantastic as Hermann Goring. He really does have that really kind of uncomfortable charm, you know, that sort of way. You do feel yourself being sucked in by it. Not obviously by the, you know, the political thing, but just the idea of, like, he is a big character, and that, you know, he is, there's a sort of dark magnetism to him, you know, like, that's done very, very well. Rami Malek, I think, was miscast in this. Leo Woodall.
Yeah.
Who plays...
Well, people know a lot from One Day and The White Lotus.
Exactly, yeah. He plays the German interpreter in this. I think he would have been better cast as Douglas Kelly, because the idea is that this US Army psychiatrist is kind of out of his depth.
Yeah.
And Goring is kind of running rings around him, whereas Malik's characterization of it is that he's so cocky and so certain of himself.
Mm.
And it doesn't really play, whereas if somebody like Leo Woodall, who is able to do vulnerability very, very well, he would have been much better in this.
Is... I forgot his name momentarily. One of the most famous actors in the world, Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Is there Oscar talk about this, do you think?
I would say so. Like, right. This is very awards friendly.
Yes.
He'll get nominated.
And he gained weight.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, like, he does look the part. I mean, he has the accent down. Yeah, again, like I say, that uneasy charm. He's got that as well. I would be really, really surprised if this won. This will get nominated for sure. I mean, it's James Vanderbilt. He's very good at doing Oscar friendly films. I would imagine Russell Crowe will get nominated for Best Actor. Although it's a fairly stacked year, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, let's see.
You know, I don't think this is going to trouble anyone in the Oscars too much.
Okay. Nuremberg is in cinemas from this Friday, which is the 12th of November. No, it's not. It's the 13th. No, it's not. It's the 14th of November. My mental calendar isn't what it used to be. What would you give stars-wise to Nuremberg?
2 out of 5.
2 out of 5?
Yeah, it's not great.
Oh, he's wielding the axe today, but that's why we pay him the big bucks. Brian Lloyd, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Brian Lloyd there, giving 2.5 stars to The Running Man and 2 stars to Nuremberg. Now, I do want to mention a film that was launched in Irish cinemas last week, Abode, by Limo Mokon, who gave us Lost and Found a number of years ago. Abode is a feature film with 5 stories connected to the theme of home. And what it means to different characters in the film. And we see different characters living in mansions or on the street, in a big city, suburbia, the countryside. And it's all about the meaning of home. It has some great Irish actors in it, from our friend, and I say that because she's been on this show and on News Talk a lot, the great Mary McAvoy, to Brendan Conroy, to Marion O'Dwyer. It was in cinemas last week. It's continuing in cinemas this week. It's getting good reviews. It's called Abode. It is Irish cinema. Go and support it. It's in your local cinema as we speak. After the break, we turn to a new Netflix film for the kids called In Your Dreams. And its director, Alex Wu, tells me about not talking down to children. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, landing on Netflix this Friday, the 14th of November, is a new animated children's movie, In Your Dreams. It's a comedy adventure with kind of serious elements to it that follows Stevie and her younger brother, Elliot, as they journey into the absurd landscape of their own dreams. If the siblings can withstand a snarky stuffed giraffe, zombie breakfast foods, and the Queen of Nightmares, then the Sandman will grant them their ultimate dreams come true. And what's their ultimate dreams to come true? They want a perfect family. Because there is some tension in their family with their mum and dad. The Sandman is voiced by the English comedian Omid Jalali, very funny man. The film was directed by Alex Wu, who has brilliant animation pedigree in that he was the story lead at Pixar, whose credits include everything from Finding Dory, Ratatouille, WALL-E, and now he went out on his own and set up his own production and made this great kids movie called In Your Dreams. And one of the motifs of the story is all about family dynamics and mothers and fathers possibly splitting up. And he has some personal experience of that, as you'll hear about in my chat with Alex Wu, who I spoke to yesterday. And I should say I watched In Your Dreams with my son, Elliot, which you'll hear us talk about.
Good. How are you, John?
Very well. So listen, I watched this with my seven-year-old yesterday, who also happens to be called Elliot, in a happy dovetailing of events. And he really enjoyed it. He was scared by it at times. He was saddened by it at times as well. But he really enjoyed it. And he was talking about it this morning on his way to school. So I found it delightful. So I apologize for starting with heavy-duty Freudianism. But I'm just wondering, like, I kept thinking, you know, the power of dreams, or Billy Joel, the river of dreams, that dreams really are a way to sort out what we want in a way, that they're kind of our friends. And I was thinking, that's what your movie's about. But you wrote it and made it. So you tell me.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, what better way to start a conversation than with Freud? I mean, just get right into it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I was so fascinated by the subject of dreams and sort of their dual meaning, you know. So dreams, you know, the ones that we have when we're asleep are sort of connected to the ones that we chase when we're awake.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought that was just such interesting subject matter to explore in a film. And I really, you know, I made this film because I think there's so much pressure on kids and even adults to realize their dreams in life. And I think that it's a great thing to pursue dreams. But, you know, dreams don't always come true in life. You know, for me, I mean, I'm very lucky I was able to make this, you know, this movie, and that's a dream come true. But so much of my life is just sort of normal, and things don't always turn out the way that I want them to. And so, you know, I wanted to make a movie that spoke to that aspect of life and the potential, you know, costs of pursuing your dreams all out. Sometimes you can get lost in a dream when you focus too much on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was very much sort of what I intended to do with film, was sort of flip the charge on dreams and nightmares.
Yeah.
Because I found that in my life, you know, occasionally, like when nightmares, things that seem like nightmares at the time, I look back at them and they are one of the most pivotal moments in my development as a person, as a human. So I think that was very much my intent with the film, is to try and, you know, flip the charge on both dreams and nightmares.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And it's funny, when you said there nightmare, I wasn't actually sure if you were referring to actual nightmares when you were asleep or a difficult part in your life. Did you mean both?
Oh, yes. I meant the metaphorical nightmares.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Because interestingly, my son kept saying to me when he was watching your film, is this a dream or is this bit real? You know, so it's very confusing in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, dreams feel real until they don't. Right.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to play with that sort of in-between space of when you don't know you're in a dream.
Yeah.
Or when you think you're in a dream, but you're actually not. That sort of limbo sort of state of mind is really interesting to me.
Yeah. And I really appreciate what you say about maybe, and particularly in this part of the world, you know, and I mean America and Europe, we've been sold this kind of dreams, follow your dreams, follow your dreams. And as you say, life doesn't always work out that way, as much as a nice ambition that is. Tell me this, reading through the production notes, and I don't know if this is too personal, but it's in the production notes, you know, my son also focused on parents splitting up or possibly separating. You had a little experience of that as a child that stayed with you, I gather, which was also a part of the genesis of this film.
Yeah. So it's not too personal because this film is very personal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I came up with the idea, you know, back in like 2017, I knew I wanted to make a movie in the dream world because that's such an untapped space, especially for animation. I mean, in live action, you have Inception, which is like one of the greatest dream movies ever made. But in the animated space, there hadn't been any sort of film that explored dreams in a really compelling way. But just a movie about the, you know, the world of dreams isn't enough. You have to pair it with a real compelling human story. And yeah, for that, I sort of tapped into something that happened to me as a kid when I was about 6 or 7 years old. I woke up one morning and my mom was, she sort of was at the front door and she had her bags packed and she had to gently explain to me and my brother that she was going away for a little while because she had to figure things out for herself and for her family. I think she, you know, she had both of us when she was quite young.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it was really scary for me and for my brother. I mean, we, you know, when you're a kid, you just kind of want your family to be together. And so we, that was sort of a big inspiration for this film. And this film is really sort of me exploring and navigating and reconciling the fact that, like, people are imperfect, families are imperfect, life is imperfect, but that doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile. And I think, you know, the messiness of life is actually what gives it meaning. That's when you get through it with those that you love, that's really what gives life, it's what makes life meaningful and worthwhile.
Sure. There's gorgeous music in it as well. And the voice cast is terrific. And we can't mention them all, but I'm always a big fan of Omid Jalali. His comedy, anyway, that I've seen, he's hilarious. And he's very so smart. But he's great as the Sandman. And I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, but he's a full-bodied man. He's a big unit, as we might say. And he's great cast in this, as this big Sandman. Did you have him in mind, or did some casting director come along, or because he's a perfect fit?
He is a perfect fit. No, you know, it was we didn't know who we wanted as the Sandman. I think we wanted somebody who had that sort of big, bold sound and that sounded very sort of jovial and very sort of avuncular. And it was Mary Hidalgo, our casting director, who suggested to Omid. And the minute we heard his voice, we just fell in love with him. I wasn't actually that familiar with his comedy because I live in the U.S. and I know he's big in the U.K. and in Europe, but in the U.S. he's not as well known. Yeah. So it was a real discovery for me, and we loved him. I mean, he's so energetic. When we brought him into the studio, he would just roll with like 50 different takes, and I wouldn't even really have to direct him. He would just go in and have all these ideas. So I loved his energy, and he brought that energy to his character in The Sandman.
Yeah, and you're right, avuncular. That's a good word. That's the one I was groping for, but you said it. I didn't. He's perfect. You know, I mentioned the music. I was talking to Jerry Bruckheimer a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, little name drop for you there, but he was talking about using Led Zeppelin, and it was very complicated and very expensive for his movie F1. The use of the Eurythmics song, you know, it's just perfect. But was it complicated to get that?
It actually was not that complicated. I mean, we pitched the idea, or our music supervisor, Chris Duridas, pitched the idea to Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart and their team. And I think because the film is about dreams, I think it was kind of a perfect fit. Mm. They also really liked the subject matter of, you know, kids dealing with you know, family uncertainty. And I think they felt like that was much needed in the animated space. So that wasn't complicated. It was very expensive, obviously, but it wasn't complicated because I think they were on board.
So. Okay, terrific. And tell me this, I was reading about the various things you've done, and you were involved in Pixar for a long time, and the things you've been involved in are some of the greatest animated movies of the last 25 years, like WALL-E alone, aside from Finding Dory and The Good Dinosaur, which is a big hit in our house with the aforementioned 7-year-old Elliot. But when you left there, and, you know, we're talking about following your dreams and all that, I get the impression setting up Cuckoo Studios, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right, yeah.
Like, was that a wing and a prayer? Because it seems madness to leave Pixar if you're in animation.
Yeah, it is madness. I mean, you know, one of the reasons we called it Cuckoo was because it was crazy for us to leave. Crazy Studios sounded pretty stupid, so we went with Cuckoo instead. It was definitely a wing and a prayer. I've never heard that phrase before, but I like it. You know, I think that the reason I left was because, you know, around 2013, I saw House of Cards, which I don't know if you remember that show.
Of course,
but I mean, it blew everybody away because nobody expected a DVD mailing company to make a show that was that good.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking at the time, wow, this company, Netflix, they were going to change the industry in a really big way. And over the next couple of years, they doubled down on originals and they just kept growing. And so I thought, you know, it's only a matter of time before they get into animation. And I thought it would be a great time to jump ship and, you know, try something on my own to try and take advantage of this industry shift. And so I tapped two of my friends on the shoulder, and to my surprise, they were game for it. And so that's why we left. But you know, the first year, it sounds really glamorous, you know, starting your own company, but man, it is hard work. The first year we had no business, no incoming work. No money. We were so poor. I mean, we had this 100 square foot office and we couldn't even afford enough chairs for the three of us to sit on. So we sat on the floor a lot. But we were really determined and we were really excited about the opportunities and what was happening in the industry with streaming. So we just, you know, kept our heads down and just kept coming up with ideas for TV shows and movies that we wanted to see. And in 2018, we pitched our first show and it got greenlit. And that show ended up, it's called Go-Go Corey Carson.
Oh, I've seen it.
Okay, great. Yeah, your son probably loves it.
Yes.
Because he was probably the perfect age when it came out. We ended up winning 3 Emmys for that. We got nominated for 8. And so Netflix was so pleased with the work that we did. They asked us what else we had and they were getting into feature animation. Mm. And so we had developed In Your Dreams in the beginning of 2017. And so we pitched that to them. They loved it. They greenlit it. And we were off to the races in the beginning of 2020.
Yeah. And there's a car reference in there, off to the races, Go, Go, Carson, which is perfect.
Yes.
And I did notice that, and it was actually Elliot, and I'll stop mentioning my son now, but he noticed Carlson. There's a little Easter egg in there.
There is.
So always be selling, I guess.
Yeah. That was our little sort of homage to our first production. There's actually, I think, 3 references to Go, Go, Corey Carson in the show. It's just these little stickers that Elliot would put on, well, the movie Elliot would put on his bed and his helmet. So I'm glad your Elliot noticed it. That's great.
Yeah. Well, listen, our time is coming to end. It's a gorgeous film for me and my Elliot, to you and yours, Elliot. It's beautiful. And I will tell people, we have a lot of parents listening to this show, so I will tell them to watch it. Lovely to talk to you and continued success, Alex.
Oh, thanks, John. Lovely to talk to you too.
Hey, want to see a magic trick?
Why do you have to be so annoying?
Open the notes, Stevie. Stevie will say, why do you have to be so... Okay, we're done here.
Hey guys, something came up and I'm headed out of town super early.
You're leaving? Dad, it's not like mom's gonna move, right?
I just don't want you to worry, honey.
Hey Stevie, look what I found.
What is that? The Legend of the Sandman.
It says the Sandman can make your dreams come true.
It's magic! I can see your crack, Houdini.
It works! We're in our dreams!
A clip there from In Your Dreams, which is now on Netflix. A great kids movie and beautiful animation as well there. And what an interesting guy Alex Wu is. And In Your Dreams is now on Netflix. And I hadn't realized this, but there's a dreamy quality to this week's Screen Time, because after the break, I'm going to be talking to a young film director who's made his first feature called Dreamtown. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, take a listen to this. We're starting this part with a song. That was a song called Dreamtown, which was originally written by the band Shane. I'll explain more about that in a minute, because I'm going to talk to you about a movie of the same name, Dreamtown. In Dreamtown, Mickey Richards, played by Anthony Murphy, is a disillusioned, aging rocker who never realized his dreams. He lives a carefree life, unfettered by responsibility, spending his days as a school janitor, occasionally hitting the bottle while being a school janitor. And at his nights, he's in a bar telling tales about his rock and roll past to much younger drinking buddies. Bartender Gina, played brilliantly by Michelle Lucy, who is fond of Mickey, is kind of trapped in her dead-end present, as he is his irredeemable, or possibly irredeemable, past. Following the end of his marriage, Mickey has neglected his son, Alan, played by Kean Hyland, who's also very good. But now that he's a musically gifted adult, Mickey decides it's time to reconnect. But his clumsy attempts to impress only drive a deeper wedge between them. Now, the film was self-financed, independently produced, written and directed over several years by Stephen McKenna, whose own father was in a band called Shane. Stephen also decided not to put a deposit down on a new house and instead chose to make this movie. The movie is currently on the RTE player. It was shown at the Galway Film Flat. I really enjoyed it. And I'm delighted to say that Stephen McKenna, the writer, director, producer of Dreamtown, I gave it a long intro, but it deserves one, is in studio. Stephen, hello.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me.
So listen, what I liked about this was the dad character, right? The aging rocker. He's brilliant as it. And he looks, and this is no disrespect to the actor Anthony Murphy, who I wasn't really aware of, but he looks very lived in. When you wrote it, he looks world weary. Did you go to him straight away or where did you find him?
So I actually found Tony Murphy from through another friend of mine.
Right.
And I had this idea of the character of Mickey Richards and the story. And my friend said, oh, you have to meet my friend Tony Murphy. As soon as I met him, I knew, I was like, okay, this guy doesn't even need to act. He just has that confidence. You kill me for saying this, sleaze. He has this very kind of confident energy.
Yeah.
And I just knew.
And a bit of charm as well.
Yeah, he does. He has a charm. And I could really see him in the role. And I figured if this guy grows a big beard or really, really long hair, it would work. If you see him now, he's very groomed, actually.
So, you know, your dad was in the music business. It came about thinking about your own dad, but I gather your dad's a very nice guy, not like
he is
the proprietor of this movie.
Yeah, the film, the main character, Mickey Richards, is absolutely not based on my father.
Yeah.
My father was actually one of the founding members in Aslan.
Oh,
before
wow.
They were Aslan, yeah.
Okay.
They were called Mila 18. And he was eventually replaced by Tony,
okay,
another bass player, and then my dad went to form another band, which is Shane.
Mm. So they and that's S-H-A-I-N-E.
Yeah, so that was around like the very late 80s, early 90s. You know, they had some success. I think their most successful song was called Dreamtown, from which the film takes its name. But the last day my father was in a recording studio was the day that I was born, and he basically made the decision to provide for his family because he wasn't able to do it with the band.
Right.
So I guess Dreamtown and the inspiration for the story kind of comes from, you know, having a dream, wanting to achieve something that's a bit, you know, it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, what if that doesn't happen? And instead of stopping or, you know, deciding to provide for his family, Mickey Richards kept going, you know.
So that was the genesis. That's interesting. So your dad, your actual dad, in a way, is the polar opposite, or two roads diverge in the yellow wood, and he took the other one.
There's some similarities. I've taken.
Does your dad bore people with rock and roll past?
No, he doesn't at all. No, just some little things he says to me I would have put into the character.
Yeah. And what's lovely about the film is it's a pretty fraught relationship at times that he has with his son, Kean. And part of me was thinking, you know, do I like the character in this? Because we wonder, is he getting interested in his son because he realises he actually has a musical talent, or is he just realising he needs to be nicer to his son? What's your take on it? Or is that meant to be an open-ended question?
Well, I guess the film isn't too... I think for me, you know, Mickey wants to have some sort of purpose, and there's a line in it where his ex-wife says to him that his son hates him and he can't handle that. So a lot of the film is, you know, Mickey trying to prove to his son that he has a cool dad, you know, that he that he isn't this failure, you know, even though he's in a lot of denial.
Yes.
Deep down, he knows what he is like.
Yeah. Without giving a spoiler, it does get kind of dark, and we have Mickey kind of staring into the abyss nearly at times. That's fair to say, right?
Well, I figured, like, when I was writing the character, for me, you know, it was about being as honest as possible. Mm. And I deliberately, you know, wanted to make him unlikable.
Mm.
I think to have a character like that, you know, who chooses the self all the time, who chooses cheap pleasures, who doesn't take responsibility, if we're being real about it, you know, he's not a nice person or a likable person. But the point of it is that by the end of it, we see him as human.
Yeah.
And maybe we can kind of empathize with him a little bit. Even if we don't agree with him, he is still human. And he's a human whose dreams have failed.
Yeah, absolutely. But there may be some redemption as the film goes on.
Yeah.
But let's not get into that.
Yeah, it's not depressing.
No, it's not. And it's a lovely Dublin-esque kind of film, I have to say. I'm closer to Mickey's age than I am to yours. And, you know, these are solitary tales. You don't want to be dining out on stories of the past. But you produced this, directed it, wrote it, financed it largely yourself. And the choice for you was get a deposit for a house together or make this movie.
Yeah. So, as you know, it's very difficult to move out, you know, and it's...
I thought you were going to say it's very difficult to make a movie because it's...
It is very difficult to make a movie, but it's something I've wanted to do, you know. It's something I still want to do. Like, I can't wait to make my next film.
Mm.
But I kind of realized, you know, I wanted to make that step into making feature films. And I had, you know, over COVID and everything, I had managed to save quite a lot of money.
Mm.
Well, the house deposit.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a lot of money these days.
Yeah. And I figured, you know, there's a few houses I was kind of looking at. They would have been down in Wexford, down in the country. And I just kind of said to myself, maybe if I'm in 2 years sitting in my home without having made this film and I was going to die, would I be happy with that? And the answer was no. So I kind of said, you know what, I can always make more money.
Yeah.
I'll find a way to do that. But to make a film, it's not easy. It's what I really want to do with my life. So
yeah,
that had to take priority.
Well, hats off to you, because you've made a lovely little movie. And I don't mean little in terms of it's small, but I think you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Now, we want people to see it. So it got a screening at the Galway Film Flat earlier this year. It's now on the RT Player.
Yeah, it was in Galway Film Festival in 2024.
Oh, 2024.
Yeah,
okay.
2024, yeah. But it's now on the RT Player, yeah.
Yeah. So I went onto the RT Player, even though you kindly sent me a link, and watch it there. It is number one there now. I'm not sure if that's their placing, but presumably that's great for you, the fact that it's right up there.
See it there. Yeah, it's really nice.
And what's the reaction been?
From what I gather, from the screenings, it seems to really connect with people. They seem to leave kind of feeling uplifted, definitely singing the song. The song seems to...
We're talking about Dreamtown.
Dreamtown, yeah. The song seems to get in people's ears.
Yeah.
But it seems to have quite a positive response, yeah. It's funny that the character is quite divisive. Some people really like him, and some people really don't like him.
Yeah.
And I'd rather that than having a meh.
But I think, as you say, he might be just human.
He is like just us human. All. Yeah, yeah, he is just human.
Well, listen, Dreamtown, which was written, directed, produced, largely financed by Stephen McKenna, is now on the RT Player. It is a lovely watch, and you should watch it. That's according to me, who knows one or two things about what movies listeners might like on this show. I've been talking to the writer, director, producer of Dreamtown, Stephen McKenna, who's been in studio. Stephen, good luck with it.
Thank you so much, John. Thanks for having me on.
Stephen McKenna there talking to me about his film Dreamtown, which, as I say, is now on the RTE Player, so do check it out. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Kerry Condon and Felicity Jones about their film Train Dreams. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me about anything movie or TV related, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Stay dry, and I will talk to you all next week.
Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100 count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.